And the reaper will come for us all.
Hi, hello. This is bonus Reaper Tales. All right, go.
Sure. Yeah. Okay. That sounds good. Yeah. So bonus content for Mental Health Month. We wanted to talk about our professionals. We wanted to talk about our own journey, but we are not professionals at all. And so we have no idea how to start this. So I'll just go first and kind of get started talking, I guess. I wanted to discuss kind of a little bit of my journey with CPTSD specifically. How I figured out that that was a thing, and also how I realized that I had it, I guess. So, as I've said in the past, I went to therapy. Actually, I don't know that I've ever told the full story, so I'll go through it briefly. Was in a toxic relationship with my ex at the time, who was never diagnosed, but I'm fairly certain borderline personality disorder. With him I was actually married for 10 years before I was divorced legally. It was like almost 12 years. But didn't realize that it was toxic, didn't realize it was abusive, because I didn't realize that verbal and, you know, non-physical abuse is still abuse, because that's not how I was raised. So stuck with it. Thankfully had a few friends like Montana that stuck with it with me and weren't willing to let me isolate myself or let him isolate me from them. So started developing a lot of different physical manifestations of the abuse that I was going through. One of those being chronic migraines. And oddly enough, he kept telling me that it was probably all mental and it was all in my head and I should go to a therapist because I had a lot of things to work through, which was probably one of the worst things he could have told me, because I had friends telling me that I actually had a friend that I had only been friends with for maybe a year. And she sent me a Facebook message talking about verbal and mental abuse. And I was like, oh, or emotional abuse. And I read that and I was like, oh, I've never heard of this, like in a clinical sense. And then he said that later and I was like, okay, well, fine. I'll go to a therapist. He's like, I think you need depressive medication or anxiety medication. There's something wrong with you. So I go to the doctor, go to the doctor's office for a therapy session. And the therapist I booked actually did not take my insurance. So I got booked with a different one. Started talking to her. And it actually ended up being a perfect fit for me. Talked to her for several weeks and she was basically like, hey, I'm going to send you this article on BPD and I want you to read it and tell me if any of it resonates with you, because she had had a boyfriend in her past. So this was very fitting for her to hear about the things that I was going through. And I read it and I was like, oh, every single symptom outside of maybe one or two he has. Okay. Realized that that's what was going on. And there was a little bit of abuse going on. And then started realizing that that sort of thing can actually show physical symptoms, which I never knew. I never even knew it was abuse. I never even knew anything was going on. Eventually led me to down the path of separating, getting a divorce, and getting separated, going through therapy the entire time. Never stopped going to therapy and never stopped seeing my best friend in North Carolina, despite the fact that she moved away from me. In fact, the first time I visited you was one of the worst situations that I had been through.
He had threatened to call the police on us if she didn't answer her phone. Which, and at the time, like we did some of that illegal green stuff quite a bit, and we were like, if we have the cops caught on us, it's going to be not great. So yeah, we had to put up with that. And then I also remember when you first moved out, like I was a fucking wreck. the whole time, you like were. You were packing up and stuff like that, I was like, oh my God, oh my God, oh my God, oh my God, oh my God. Because it happened within like 3 hours. It was, and I was all the way up here. But then as soon as you got into your new place, I was down there with you like every other month.
Yeah, because so I made the decision because I basically drove to work for a solid week. And I don't know what the trigger was. I still don't. But I cried every day on my way to work. Because I was thinking, is this the way that I want to live my life? I am 30 years old. Do I want to live the next 30 to 60 years, however long I have on this earth, like this? I don't. And I cried and I cried and I cried. And then I remember leaving work and sitting in my car. And I called Montana first and told her the decision I had made. And she's like, well, I can't come down there. I'm like, that's okay. I have two other friends I'm going to call after I get off the phone with you. I'll be okay. I just wanted you to know that I made this decision. Thankfully, one couldn't come, but the other one could. And I said, I need to do this while he's gone because I don't want to risk having to deal with him while I get my stuff out. And that was the most nerve-wracking, like, five-hour spread. I had everything planned. I moved in with one of my best friends for a few weeks while I got an idea of an apartment together. Because I had never lived on my own at this point. I got married at 19. So straight from my parents' house to a house with him, and I had no idea what I was going to do. And thankfully, they helped me. But it was straight up exactly what an abusive relationship looks like. I said, I wrote him a letter. I said, I don't want you to contact me. I want you to give me space while I figure things out. And if you love me, and you want this to work, you will give me the space I'm requesting, give me the time to figure things out, and I will contact you when I'm ready. Not even an hour after he found out I had left, because the neighbor reported to him what was going on when he saw the moving van pull into my driveway, he was texting me and calling me and leaving me voicemails trying to get me to contact him about what was going on. And then he sent me a text and said, the neighbor just told me you left me. I can't believe that you would do this. I don't know what drove you to this, but I'm so sorry. Please come back, blah, blah, blah. And I said, I literally asked you to just give me some time, and you could not even give me 24 hours. I spent 2 days with my friend that helped me move out, then moved in with my best friend that I've known for over half my life at this point. Lived with her for several weeks, and then I got the apartment, like Montana said, moved into there. Thankfully, I had some friends that helped me move, and God bless y'all, because I am sorry that I asked for your help, because at 30 plus years old, it is not easy. It is not fun.
No, and you got an apartment. She got a third story walk-up apartment.
Yeah, like, it was an amazing apartment, but moving was, it sucked.
Gorgeous. I mean, it was the old ones where it's like, what do you historical. Imagine, like Friends? Like the yeah. inside where you have to like walk in, but the stairway is like more narrow.
Pivot.
Eh.
There is no pivoting.
Yeah, there's no make it pivot. Work. Her and Dad, when I first came and visited her in the new apartment, she had no living room furniture. So she was like, she had one chair. I was like, aww. Are we
just my grandmother's furniture that my parents had given me. That's the only furniture I had. And wow. yeah. didn't include living room furniture.
And so I like immediately got on Craigslist and Facebook Marketplace. And I was like, okay, we're going to find you some living room furniture. And we did. Like,
I was like, I'll get it eventually. And she's like, no, no, you're not.
No, we're doing this
if
now.
I don't get it for we're you, you're not going to do it.
New furniture. It was like a love seat, a couch, and a cute chair.
It was impressive.
Coffee tables, all that thing. For like, what was it, $400? Maybe?
I think it ended up being 600, but it was like, it was a rug, a table, two end tables, a love seat, and a couch.
Two lamps.
And a chair. Two lamps. Also a front rug, like a door rug, and all of the pillows that went along with it too. So, I mean, it was a very nice set. That was probably like $2,000-$3,000.
Yeah.
And it had been sitting in their extra sitting space.
Their bonus
room.
So they
never used it.
Yeah. They didn't let the kids get on it apparently. But it was a wild time because even then, like, you were still dealing with him. He was still around.
I was. He was still messaging, talking, trying to make things work. We went through counseling for a while. And then I realized that that was not going to go anywhere, and we weren't going to make any progress. We went to a counseling session, and he basically finally, after love bombing me, which is a technical term, 4 months throughout the counseling sessions, literally blamed me for everything that had gone wrong in our relationship, everything wrong in his life, and that everything was my fault, that I just left him, and I'm the reason why our relationship wouldn't work. And I sat there crying, and my therapist let our couple's therapist, not my therapist, but the couple's therapist let that happen. And he left, and I was still there. And she said, and some therapists have argued this, but I kind of understand where she's coming from. She said, I let that happen because I knew it was coming, and I needed you to see that for you to know what your next step is, because you've been putting in all this effort up to this point. And that was the turning point for me, I think. I realized this isn't going anywhere. He's not really trying. He's just, he's doing what he needs to do until he can get me back. And then it's going to go right back to the status quo. And sure enough, the dominoes started falling, so to speak, and he just started spiraling. And I realized, okay, got a divorce attorney, went through all that process, got through it all. Going through therapy the whole time with my therapist, thought I had dealt with it all. And I had made a lot of progress. I was living on my own for the first time in my entire life. I was enjoying it. I loved my apartment. I loved my life. I was not loving dating. That sucked. Would not recommend. I was very tired of that. Met some great people, met a lot of not great people. I went through a relationship during that time that was desperately needed as kind of a, not a rebound, because I don't think I had a rebound, but it was a
palate cleanser.
Bridge. Yeah. Kind of a palate cleanser. That's a good way of putting it. Made me realize that there were other options out there, because my biggest fear throughout this whole process was that I was never going to find somebody that loved me as much as he loved me. And if that's what love was that okay? Was I ever going to find something better than that or as good as that? And I didn't know, because I got married to him at 19 and I had been in that relationship for so long, but I just knew I wasn't happy. And that kind of opened my eyes to, yeah, I can love other people and other people can love me in a different way. It didn't end well, but at the same time, it ended much faster than my previous relationship. It didn't take 10 or 11 years. I figured out when it got to a point that it wasn't healthy for me, and I got out of it. And that was progress for me, and I saw that as progress. And dated a little bit more, met the person that is now my husband, was immediately suspicious because I was entirely too comfortable with him after the first date, which had red flags all over it, because this is not normal. I've never felt this way with somebody that wasn't my two best friends. Little did I know that it's literally just because we just clicked. And it was that type of situation where it was like, I told him, because both of us had this conversation later, but I said, it was almost like my whole being that's riddled with anxiety every time I meet somebody new. It was like the second we started talking, my whole being just took a deep breath and sighed and relaxed when I sat down with him and we were talking. And he said he felt the exact same thing, and he felt the exact same way. This is a red flag. I'm just missing something. There's something here. This is not right. This is too easy. There's something wrong here. We're missing it. And it was kind of funny because we went back and forth and we were like, this just doesn't seem right. It can't be this easy. There's something wrong here. We're missing something. There's definitely something. Well, he had had a similar situation to me. So for both of us, it was like both of us were seeing each other and we were seeing something similar in each other. And it just made us both feel comfortable. And I say that because Montana did not like him when she first met him.
Which is so funny because him and I are so much alike. Like, she just married the male version of me in a lot of ways. So but just like immediately I was like, oh, fuck this dude. Are you serious? God. Why does he look like Dave Grohl?
Yeah, I don't know that you necessarily said that, but it definitely occurred.
A lot of it was in my head. But even like, even with your first marriage and like that situation, I never said anything bad about him, even though I knew it and he had done some things that directly to me that I didn't like, that were not okay. I never said anything until you came out and was like, this is fucked up. And I'm like, girl, yeah, let me tell you. Like, but I didn't really say anything about like the whole like Paul thing in the beginning, because I'm like, I do tend to make like snap judgments, especially when it comes to like my friends and who they allow in their life. Yeah, I'm immediately suspicious. Like, you, Kelsey, was with Michael for almost 2 years, and I was like, this motherfucker put her in the hospital.
So, that's fair.
I mean, it took a while. I mean, I love Paul to death. So that went away. But yeah, I think he was the best thing for you. It was such a, I think I was suspicious too, because it was such a difference. He was so different than what you had previously had, and he was so different than a lot of guys are, because Paul's a very, he just listens to you. Anybody, he's like, oh, okay, that makes sense. Like, you could be like, that was fucked up, Paul. Like, I hate that. You hurt my feelings. And he goes, well, okay, I didn't, I'm sorry, I won't do it again. Like, he's just so understanding. So he's like, he's kind of perfect.
Yeah, not, well, I mean,
if he's listening, he's to this, you're not perfect, but
he's perfect for me. But yeah, and good God bless, he puts up with a lot. So I'm not perfect, he's not perfect, but we're perfect for each other. We put up with each other and we teach each other things, and we are willing to grow and learn as we go through this thing we call life. And, you know, both of us felt like we were bringing something to the relationship that was almost insurmountable. I had all my past trauma and all my stuff going on, and I didn't have any kids. He had 4 kids, and that was a huge thing for me to deal with. But for him, I was willing to at least consider it. I took my time, and I wanted to make sure that this was something long-term before I met his kids. But, and I wanted to make sure I had wrapped my brain around that before I met his kids. I wanted to make sure I was okay with that. And, you know, that took time. And I think we did things the way that we should have. We did take that time. There were moments where, of big growth with him, like, my therapist, I remember the day that he goes, I feel like I need to tell you something, but I don't expect you to say it back. And I'm like, well, I know what this is, where this is going, because at least 2 other guys that I had dated had had this exact same conversation with me. And I was like, okay, go for it. And that was the first time that he ever told me that he loved me. And I was like, okay. And he goes, I don't expect you to say it back, because I know that that's not something easy for you, but I felt like I needed to tell you. And he literally meant it. He didn't expect me to say it back. He didn't want to rush me. And I immediately called Montana, and I was like, okay, so he said this thing and I really don't know what to do. And I'm a little bit confused, and I really don't know what to do. And Montana was like, girl, you're being stupid. You know you love him. Like, why didn't you just say it back? Like, you're telling me all of this stuff. Why don't you just say it back? And the next day I had my therapy appointment. Said the same thing to my therapist.
She said the same thing.
And she said the exact same thing. She was like, girl, I have been waiting for you to open up, because vulnerability wasn't something I was good at. And she's like, I've been waiting for this for so long. And I was like, but I'm scared. She goes, well, yeah, that's how it works when you're vulnerable. So I said it, and I moved to the next level, and we've had moments of vulnerability, and I started realizing vulnerability was the problem for me. It was opening up and allowing somebody to have the space to hurt me that I hadn't been able to do in so long. So I learned and I grew through that relationship, to the point of being scared to tell him when he did something wrong or he did something that hurt me. And I would come to him, and I had had 3 days to plan this argument out, and I had my retorts and I had my responses all prepared. And I would go to him and I'd say, you know, when you said this thing 3 days ago, it really hurt and it really bothered me. And he goes, oh God, why did it take you so long to come to me? I'm so sorry. Just tell me. I won't do that again. I'm so sorry. And I'm like,
what?
What? Oh, well, now I don't know what to do because I was ready for an argument. And then he would do the same thing for me. So it was growth for both of us, I think, and it was what we both needed. And so now we're settling into a common, like, we're in this stage of growth, things are going well. And then there was another wave that hit, and that wave was what set off my CPTSD. And it was what I thought I had had controlled up to this point. I thought I had it under control, never heard of CPTSD, didn't even know it was a thing. I won't go into detail.
Can you tell us what it stands for? I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt. Yeah. But can you tell us what it stands for?
So CPTSD is, PTSD is post-traumatic stress disorder. And that is typically associated with people in high stress environments where it's a singular or several singular situations that have set off a traumatic response of fight or flight. That's kind of the rough definition of it. You typically see this in people who have been in situations like war combat, or they've been in like the 9/11 situation. People had a lot of PTSD from that, situations like that. CPTSD, which is now finally getting recognized as an official diagnosis, is chronic post-traumatic stress disorder, defined by them as 6 months or longer of a traumatic, stressful event that you go through for 6 months or longer that causes you to have a traumatic response to something that triggers it. And it can be, the problem with CPTSD is it can be anything. I mean, it's somewhat similar with PTSD, but it can be a little bit, it can sometimes be a little easier to expect with PTSD because you're looking at like loud noises or a fan that's moving like helicopter blades or fireworks or a flash. Those types of things would be setting it off. But with CPTSD, you lived in it for 6 months or more. So the smallest thing that reminds you of that time period can take you back as if you are in that traumatic experience, and your body doesn't know that it's no longer in that situation, and it now has a anxiety attack or a panic attack or whatever. It has a stress-induced reaction to the situation you're in, and it's not easy to tell. When you don't know what's going on, it's not easy to know what those triggers are going to look like, especially for CPTSD. So it can be as simple as cooking dinner at home, and you happen to cook a meal that you cooked at one point in time during that time frame that you were in that stressful situation, and you've done it dozens of times. But today, for some reason, that moment takes you back to that situation. And all of a sudden, your heart starts racing and you start sweating and you start shaking and you start getting really upset. And if there's a person around you, they may say something and you'll snap at them and they touch you and you will jerk away from them because all of a sudden you are in a fight or flight situation and you don't know why. And if you don't know what you're going through, you don't know how to get yourself out of that. And it can be very difficult to learn the best way of getting yourself out of that. So the reason why it's been so hard to diagnose is because for the longest time, emotional, mental, verbal abuse was not recognized as a real abuse. It wasn't recognized as something that is putting you through trauma for an extended period of time. And 6 months is long enough. So when you're talking about somebody who has been in a marriage for 2, 5, 7, 10, 20, 30 years of it, it can be extremely hard for you to get out of that. And it can also be extremely hard for you to even know what your triggers are and what's going to cause you to be in that situation all of a sudden. And so I had no idea. I didn't even know it was a thing. And I had 10 years of it. Not to mention what I learned later, the decade or more of my parent putting me in that situation as well. And that can be caused by all of the things that I mentioned, you know, and obviously physical abuse can also be a part of that as well. I'm not minimizing physical. I'm just speaking from my own experience. So that's the difference between the two of them. They're both now formally recognized. I think the, what is it? The World Health Organization is finally recognizing that as an official diagnosis.
The WHO.
I think that's who it's called. Anyway, so I had already realized I had generalized anxiety. So we were working through coping mechanisms for that. And I started to recognize when I was in certain situations with Paul or when his kids were over, certain things would trigger me and I would go into fight or flight or freeze. There's actually one more, fight, flight, freeze, or I think there's another one now.
Yeah, it's fight, flight, freeze.
Fawn.
Yeah.
Fight. The fight response is your body's way of facing any perceived threat aggressively. Flight means your body urges you to run from danger. Freeze is when your body's inability to move or act as a threat. And fawn is your body's stress response to try to please someone to avoid conflict. So that sounds like the new one.
Yeah. And it should be recognized because all of those are a way to get you out of the stressful situation. And for people who have been in stressful situations with people who have narcissistic personality disorder or borderline personality disorder, very frequently, fawn is the way you do it. You try to calm them in any way possible and whatever you need to do in order to get them to calm down because they're yelling at you. They're screaming at you. They're calling you names. They're blaming you. They will not let you leave. They will not leave you alone. They will not let you sleep. They will not let you leave. So all you want is for them to just stop so you can think, so you can breathe. And most people will go to that. They learn to do that. The freeze is also extremely common. And because fight or flight aren't options in those situations more often than not, which is why those two have been added. You don't have the option to leave and you don't have the option to fight. I used to do that with my ex and it never ended well. So I started recognizing those things, talked to my therapist about it. We realized that that's what was going on. And she said, okay, well, guess what? Now's the time we get to grow even more. And we get to put in more effort and more work in order to work through the things that happened to you in the past that were not your fault and were not fair. But unfortunately, we now have to work through them. She didn't say it that way, but that's basically how I felt. So in this situation, the stressor was brought about by the current situation that I was in. Not going to go into details, but it was just a new stressor that I'd never dealt with before. And it started making me realize that my trauma went back to even my mom. So the thing that was a lot harder to deal with, I'd never even dealt with a lot of the things that went on with that. I thought I had moved past that and just, it's fine. It's whatever. It's what I grew up with. I've moved past that. I'm living my life and I'm good. Unfortunately, that's not necessarily the case. Your brain still holds on to some of that trauma. And so I had to work through some of that. And it was a big growth opportunity for me. But realizing that I had that CPTSD made me research and look into it. And I've talked about it in our Q&A session, but and I won't go into detail, but I looked up a lot of that. And I looked up what are coping mechanisms? What are ways that I can work through this. But one of the best things that my therapist actually told me, and I think this is probably hard for people who have had trauma back from their parents, write a letter to your younger self. Find a timeline, whatever timeline speaks to you, and write a letter to that younger self and tell them from your experience today what you want them to know about their future. And what you want them, speak to them like you wanted your mom to speak to you. And I wrote a 3-page letter to my like 12-year-old self and bawled, almost like I'm about to do now, because I was my parent to my younger self for that moment, the one that I always wanted, that spoke life into me and that said, it's okay to have these issues. It's okay to feel frustrated and disappointed and upset. There's nothing wrong with you and it will get better. I promise you it will get better. And that was one of the most healing things I ever did for myself, was to write a letter to my younger self. And I still have that letter and I'll read it sometimes, but I never even knew I had an issue still from that. So that was one of the best recommendations she made. Since then, I've done a lot. Believe it or not, exercise is the key to a lot of it. Actually exercising on a regular basis and trying to eat well as you can, whether that's eating what you have in front of you or whatever is easy to get to, but just eating on a regular basis is perfectly fine. Just add protein to it, whatever. But focusing on my health and my well-being has helped a lot. But exercise was a huge piece of the pie. And for me, that was hiring a personal trainer that would hold me accountable. Continuing to journal and sometimes write letters to myself in the past. That actually does help heal. But those are the things that I've worked through for what I've gone through. I still have a long way to go. And unfortunately, because I have CPTSD, it'll never go away completely. There are always going to be triggers and there's always going to be things that could set me off. But thankfully, I'm more aware of it and I've made my husband more aware of it so he can see the signs. We've had a lot of talks and I cannot say it enough. When it comes to mental health, your partner is your lifeline. They should know. What are your triggers? What are the things that they should be aware of? Because sometimes I'm in that situation. I'm in that flight or flight. And I don't know. I'm just trying to survive all of a sudden. And he has to step in and say, hey, you're safe. You're okay. He has to hold me or hug me. And if I push him off, he has to keep holding me because he knows that that's what's going to ground me at that moment. There are those things that you need to know and let that partner know or your best friend know. Because sometimes I've been out with Montana or I've been out with one of my other friends and that it out of nowhere, it'll hit just when we're out and about for no reason. And they have to know to look for that and be able to help you see that. It's your responsibility, but let them know so they can be there for you like they want to be. And yeah, how they can help you in those moments.
Even before you got diagnosed, when one of those episodes would come about, I mean, I could tell I didn't know what was happening. I just could tell that, like, you weren't well. Something was not right.
I wasn't
right
there. I wasn't present. I wasn't in the present moment.
And so sometimes we would be on our way to, like, meet somebody, and I would just call them up and be like, JK, we're not coming. Sorry, we're going to go get tacos or we're going to go veg out.
Oh, yeah, we did do that a few times. Or go to cookout. and we're going to veg in front of the TV and watch One Piece and not do anything else.
Correct, Amanda. Boy, howdy.
But anyway, so that's my very long overview of my situation. And I now have Montana's favorite cat meowing at me. I can't pick him up though. That's all I got. So I'm gonna hand it over to Montana.
Oh no, thanks for sharing. I'm perfect.
Obviously.
Sucks to have mental health issues, guys. I don't. Now I know you said we were gonna like freestyle this. There's a lot of stuff that I dealt with like growing up that I don't 100% remember or know the specifics of. It's kind of been a journey of getting old medical records, especially from places that are no longer there, to really understand like the scope of, you know, what I had as like a child, and does that still equate to who I am today and all that other stuff. But so I won't really go into that. Mainly, I've always had like kind of this underlying like anxiety. And I remember when I first moved out on my own, 18, 19, something like that, there was a stint where I was having panic attacks randomly. And I got medication for that. And I had tried some like daily stuff, but really the as needed medication
worked best, because I've tried a lot of SSRIs and they don't work well for me. They're great for a lot of people, but they just weren't great for me. And then I went, you know, several years without really any issue, or recognizing that there was an issue, I guess, is a better way of putting that. Because, I mean, Samantha has been there when I've had panic attacks before I was, you know, really diagnosed with anything. And she knew what it was. I mean, we all knew what it was. I just refused to acknowledge that it was a problem or that it was there. Because in my head, I was like, I don't want to be on medication. Like, and this is something that you have to, if I acknowledged that it was there, I was going to have to medicate it. I was going to have to do something about it. And I just didn't want to do anything about it. And it really took like, it took a hard left turn. It was right before COVID. Somebody in my family had a very devastating medical issue. It was my brother. He had an AVM and it ruptured, and he had several strokes, and it was just, you know, he's only 5 years older than me, and seeing somebody who is so young have that happen to them, and it just lived in his brain for all these years, and then one day it decided to kaput. He's still alive, by the way, but he is permanently disabled. And the idea that something like that could happen sent me into a spiral, because I became so terrified of just anything happening. I could have a stroke tomorrow. I could go to sleep and not wake up. I mean, there were times where I had to call Samantha. And even to this day, there are times where if I'm alone in the house, I cannot take a bath without having Samantha on the phone, because I'm afraid I'm going to have like a stroke in the bathtub and drown myself, or have a seizure and drown myself. And like, that's not healthy thought processes, obviously. But at that point, when this was happening and this was like spiraling in my head, I had also gone into like a really high demand job. And previously, like I had a high demand job before, but it wasn't as, the pressure wasn't as high in those other ones. Like, it asked a lot of me, but I was also appreciated. And I worked in an environment that was understanding with, you know, my type of work, the way I work, because it's not normal. I don't work normal hours. I don't, like, you know, it's not normal. And then COVID hit. And I had not completely like forgotten that fear of, you know, oh, anything could happen. Oh, I could have a stroke at any moment, blah, 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 blah. It was just kind of like transferred into, if I leave my house and I get this disease, I will die. Like, that was what was in my head for months on end. And it began to show it's like the signs of, physically show signs that I was unwell. And I had, when COVID started, I started a routine where I went and walked for an hour every single day at 11. And I was on like a strict diet, because it wasn't a strict diet, it was like a planned diet. So everything in my life was planned. I was on a schedule. I had planned out my meals. I knew what was going to happen, because I had just come from a working environment in which I had to plan everything, because I was waking. I'd have to get up at 5 o'clock in the morning. I had to be at work at 7. I had to, you know, everything was so organized, and I had forced myself to be that way because I couldn't function otherwise. And now I was always at home. And I wasn't around anybody, and I was afraid to leave my house. And there was one Saturday morning where I did not feel well. Like, I had a scratch, because, you know, when COVID hit, it was like spring, and I get really bad allergies. Like, sometimes it's just awful. And I had like a scratchy throat that morning. And I knew in my head, like, this is allergies, but I didn't know. And I began to just
panic, like just this. And I ignored it. I was like, you're fine. Like, you're not panicking. You're okay. You know, this
if I just say it loud enough in my head, it'll be fine.
Yeah. And I remember sitting like in my office at the old house, and I was like, you're gonna, like, you're in the back of my head. I was like, you're gonna die. Like, you're gonna die. And I was just like, oh shit, like, I'm gonna die. And I stood up because I was like, okay, maybe if I go and eat something, I will feel better. Because sometimes when I get really hungry, I get kind of dizzy and all of that other stuff. I was like, go eat something. Like, maybe you'll feel better after that. And when I stood up, I got really dizzy. And I just kind of, whoop, right into the ground. And I was like, oh shit, this is it. This is it. It's over. It's done with. What I didn't know, and what a lot of people didn't know at that time, because I went to the doctor and then I went to a specialist, and they were like, oh, you probably had vertigo. Like, that can happen. I was like, but it can happen because of why? Because of whom? Because of what? And nobody could really, like, give me an answer. They, you know, whatever. And looking back on it now, I know that that was a panic attack. I know that that's what it was. And so I went on about my life. And a few weeks later, I was out walking. And I had had some issues in this neighborhood specifically while walking where I had to start changing up the times that I was walking, which didn't really work well for me because I hate schedules. I hate being organized, and it's hard for me to do, but I thrive on a schedule and I do really well on it. So I was changing up the time because there were men in the neighborhood who would see me out walking, and they would go and they would all gather on a porch and they would watch me. And I'd had a few of them like run out and try and talk to me. And, you know, this is still beginning-ish area of COVID. And I'm terrified to be around anybody. And now I'm like terrified that a group of men who I don't know are watching me. And then there was another time that a dog chased me, but that was a different story. Anyway. And it was a big dog and I was scared. But so I
and
was.
And that's when you got the bracelets.
That's when I got the bracelets. I got a woven bracelet that had a hidden knife in it. Yeah.
Oddly enough, the dog was what got you to do that.
Yeah. It was. I also got some pepper spray. But yeah, so I'm like freaked out. But I'm trying to get myself to go out and go walk because I know that's what's going to be best for me. And I had two panic attacks within like a week of each other, which was very uncommon. And my husband had to leave work one time because I was like, I'm going to die. Like, I think I am dying. Because that's what you feel like in a panic attack. You think that you are dying. It's like you're slipping off the side of a building and you just can't grab onto anything. It is the worst feeling in the world. And so he came home, and I remember one time, the second time that that happened, he was like, okay, well, you need to see somebody. I was like, I don't need to see anybody. This too shall pass, my friend. And we ended up trying like CBD, and that helped a little bit, but it wasn't good enough. And the final straw for him and for me was, there was one day where I could feel a panic attack coming on because there's kind of like this lead up to it. And I was like, okay, well, the dumbest idea. I was like, okay, go walk. And that's good for some people. That is good for some people that can get you like redirected in a different way. But this was not okay with me because the reason why I was having so many panic attacks and things like that, I was feeling so anxious was because I was afraid to leave my house. Was afraid I was going to be attacked. I was afraid that I was going to have a heart attack and die. Everything scared me. And so by putting myself in the situation that I was already afraid of, I only intensified what was going to happen. And I remember getting halfway around like the loop in my neighborhood and I could not bend my knees. And I could not open my hands. They were like clawed up. Like this. And I was like, if you just keep walking, it will eventually stop. but I couldn't keep walking because I could not feel my legs. And this panic attack had become so physical. I could not feel my limbs and I could not speak clearly. Like, I could not even open my mouth fully because I was just so locked up. And my husband, I finally I got to where I could move, and I called my husband and he came home and he took me to my doctor. And when we got in to see my doctor, he was just my general practitioner. It was like right down the road. We got in there, they took my blood pressure and they were like, "We'll be right back." And they come back and they take my blood pressure again. And they were like,
I love it when they have that reaction. They're like, hold the phone a minute. And then they just leave. And you're like, that wasn't an act. That wasn't an answer. What's happening right now?
You just made it worse.
I'm panicking. Why are you not giving me anything right now?
And so
you are not helping.
They come back, they do my blood pressure again. They go, it seems to be lowering, which I actually have like a white coat syndrome. Anytime I go in to see a doctor, any type of doctor, my blood pressure goes up anyway.
Same.
But in this situation, they were like, yeah, if it had not started to go down, we were going to have to put you like in a hospital because it was that high. And they were like, yeah.
Imagine how high it was before you got there.
Right. And I was like, okay, yeah, it sounds like this is anxiety. And I think that was right around the time after Trip was born too. Was it? No. Trip was born shortly after that.
If this was during COVID, he was born at the very end of the year. So like COVID started in like March.
He was because of COVID.
Yeah, he's a lockdown baby for show.
He has a lockdown baby.
No, but it is interesting, the timing, because this would have been right around the time that I was starting to have some of the CPTSD issues coming up. And I actually got on medication for depression and anxiety, i.e. mood stabilizers and antidepressants, right around this time. Would have been within months of it. So thanks, COVID.
Thanks, COVID. It fucked a lot of us up in a lot of ways.
It brought a lot of things to light, too, I feel like. Like, things, you know, like, I mean, just the two of you just now, the mental health, like, it sort of brought that out to where it can be treated better or managed the right way.
Yeah, truly. And this is kind of a long thing, and I'm sorry, because in the end, it turns out, like, I do have anxiety, but it's not, like, and we'll get to it, but pretty much I went to the doctor, they put me on Zoloft, which I had never been on, but I had been on SSRIs before, and they just didn't work well for me. And I remember, because I think you were on it at the same time, Kelsey, right? And so I talked to you about it, and you really loved it, and I tried it for, I think, 6 months, and it just...
This must have been after Trip was born then, because we were at my old apartment pool and we were talking about it. Samantha was in town too. There was one point we all talked about it, but either way, yes.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. Cause I had taken it at some point when I was a teenager, when my mom thought I had my own issues and I was actually just a teenager dealing with teenage issues and hormones going all over the place. And it was not a good thing for me. Cause I remember talking to you about that, but you took it for a while, and I mean, teach his own, but unfortunately it takes a while to get the right one whenever you're going through that stuff, which sucks.
So I was on that for about 6 months, and it just didn't work well for me. I had some pretty bad side effects, and I did not like if I did not take it within 24 hours of the last dose, I would immediately have withdrawal symptoms, and I just did not like it. So they put me on they swapped me to a different medication that's not an SSRI, and it seemed to help. It definitely did. And then they upped the dose, and it seemed to help, but I still had like this underlying anxiety, and I was still having some panic attacks. So they gave me an as needed to help with the panic attacks. And after being on that for 2 years, I finally told my doctors, and I was in an intensive therapy, like, it was a whole thing. I told my doctors, I was like, you know, since I started this medication, I've gotten a lot of like coping skills and things like that. underway, I want to get off this medication. Because even in my head, I was like, I don't think that this is doing the job that they think it is. You know, I still had like quite a bit of anxiety, and I went off of it, and that was probably, it was around this time last year. I think it was.
Sounds about right.
Yeah. And just within like, I don't know, a couple of weeks of being off of it, my anxiety was still just pretty significantly bad. And I was having trouble just doing daily things. And I realize now, like, I had always had trouble doing daily things, but it had just become significantly worse over the course of this whole time frame. And we had started, we'd always joked that I had ADHD. Like, it's always been a joke. Or Samantha might have been serious.
I wasn't joking. But it's fine.
I wasn't joking. And I brought it up.
It was one of those, ha, 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 but really.
But really.
Maybe you should get tested.
And I started looking into ADHD. Like, you know, everybody knows ADHD and all of that stuff. And,
No, I think a lot of people think they know. I don't think a lot of people actually know.
So I talked to my therapist and she's like, yeah, let's do the test. And, you know, 10 minutes later.
Meanwhile, her therapist was like, yeah, sure.
Let's do the test.
So we have paperwork to confirm what I already know also. But okay, sure. Yeah.
Well, she's listening to this, I'm sure. Hi. So I got that confirmed. And then I got tested again with my psychiatrist. And she's like, yep, you have combined ADHD, which is inattentive and hyperactive. It's both sides of it. And I was like, okay, now I know what it is. Let me just... There were a few weeks where I was like, okay, we're going to try and manage this without medication. Because I had just come off of medication. I just spent 2 years with medication. And in my head, I had taken ADHD medication previously when I was younger, a lot younger, and I didn't like it. Or it didn't do what I needed it to do. It wasn't effective and it didn't last as long. And so we finally had the discussion. I was like, hey, these are my reservations about it. And my psychiatrist was like, well, let me put you on this one. It's longer lasting and I think it'll benefit you a lot more. And I delayed getting it filled until Samantha was like, I think it was you. You were like, go get it filled. Go get it filled. The first
thing like, I don't, but I don't want to. And I'm like, but what is the downside? Worst case, you try it and it doesn't work, then you know it doesn't work and you can stop taking it. I don't mm-hmm. understand the reservation. You're like, but I don't want to. Well, that's not fair. Because I have to work with you.
There was a lot of crying. I love you. And there was a lot of stuff, but yeah. So first day I took it.
I think what we ended up doing, the agreement was you were going to take it. And I was going to check on you because you were worried about how you were going to feel. I was like, okay, yeah. we'll check in every so often and see how you feel.
And it was like a switch flipped. It was, you know, previously I had taken other medications and it had helped, but it had not helped to this extent. I didn't realize that everybody else didn't walk around with a million thoughts constantly pinging through their head all at once. It's like there's this noise that you just can never cut off. And I didn't know that that wasn't normal. I thought everybody had that. And throughout all of this, over the past year, I've learned so much about different things and different aspects of ADHD that, you know, I've shown symptoms of or done for my entire life, and I just didn't know it. You know, the anxiety was a symptom of the ADHD because my brain never stopped the whole
when I sit down to watch a movie with you guys, like y'all used to joke at me because immediately I would fall asleep. And it's because as soon as I am not doing something, it's not, I'm not falling asleep. I'm passing out. Like, boom, it's done. I'm done. And hyper fixating on things. Like we joke about me doing it and it can be funny, but it's also exhausting. It is so exhausting because I can't, once I'm in it, I cannot stop. And medication doesn't fix that. A lot of therapy and learning how to cope and how to cut it off does. But even learning all that stuff doesn't mean that it stops, doesn't mean that it's, you know, it's an easy thing to do. And, you know, the medication has helped, but it's not a fix-all. ADHD can be devastating. And I think a lot of the times people look at it and they're like, oh, they're quirky and they're funny and they, you know, they're scatterbrained and they can't remember anything. But the reality of it is when I went without my medication for a couple of weeks recently, Samantha had to come into town. She had to help me with my life. She had to come and clean my house and call a bunch of people and just
I didn't have to get things in order.
You didn't have to.
I chose to. But I was suffering.
I was struggling.
I mean, I think that's with any, I think that's a lot of different things. It's like OCD. People joke about OCD, but OCD is not something about having to have things in order and having to do things a certain way. It's literally a compulsion. You're literally hearing a voice in your head that says, if you don't knock on that door three times, then something bad's going to happen. If you don't, you know, lock a door three times, then somebody's going to bust in. It can be debilitating and it can be very difficult to deal with. And ADHD is another one of those things where it can be kind of funny, but when you live it or when you're somebody who lives with somebody with it, it's not funny. It can be scary sometimes. It can be difficult sometimes. It can be exhausting sometimes, but it is something that you can learn to work through and you can learn to make it something that's easier to live with, but it's something you'll always live with. That's the thing.
Yeah. There'll be and like I said before, you know, I was so strict on like the schedule that I had when I was going into work because I had to be, and I didn't recognize or realize at that point that the reason I was doing it was I had subconsciously done this to mitigate a lot of the symptoms that ADHD brings about. And as soon as I was at home,
extreme structure.
And as soon as I was at home, I didn't have that structure. And I actually everything wasn't planned out to the second. I was like, oh, I think I actually like this better because like I can actually breathe for once, but also I cannot breathe because I'm having a panic attack. So,
well, now it's on you. Now it's on you to create the structure. And that makes it a lot more terrifying, just in general.
Yeah. And
object permanence, all of those things that go along with ADHD, like it's something that you should educate yourself on so that you can understand the aspects of what's going on. Why do I feel this way? And what can I do to make my own life better? Not for other people, but so that I can live my life and be okay with how I live it and feel free.
And it's exhausting. And I struggle with it still, obviously. But it's, you know, I'm a work in progress. And now that I know exactly what it is and the best ways to treat it and the best things that work for me and the things that don't, it's easier. But I will say that as far as like talking about ADHD, I've tried a lot more to bring it up to people and be like, hey, like I actually have this. Especially with like coworkers and things like that. When I was out of my medication, I made sure to tell them, hey, I'm going to be easily irritated for a little bit. I'm going to be a little bit scattered. It will not affect my work. I will still get my work done, but I need you to know that these are some of the symptoms that you might see because I can't get my medication. And, when you tell people that you have ADHD, there is a lot of like, it's hard to tell people because there is a lot of like, oh, that's like a made up thing, or they just, they have too much energy, or everybody has ADHD. Like, no, this is debilitating a lot of the time.
And it is so brave that you were able to do. I know that you kind of didn't have a choice by telling them because you were out of your medication, but like that takes a lot of courage to do that. And you should be proud of yourself for having the courage to do that because, yeah, that's not easy.
So just remember, if you're dealing with somebody with ADHD or somebody says that they have ADHD, it is devastating. It can be devastating, and it is debilitating a lot of the times. And by minimizing what it is, like it's fine to joke if they're okay with it, but just know that they are struggling. This is not easy. I would give my left and right boob not to have this 100%. I'd give one of Samantha's boobs not to have it. Like,
okay, fair.
You're like, what boob? Oh my God.
I didn't say a damn thing.
Oh man. So that's my whole thing. Just like deal with your mental health issues. Like it's easy for me in hindsight to say, don't be ashamed to like be medicated, go to therapy, get it checked out, because I've struggled so long. And that was one of the other things with getting this diagnosis and getting on medication. It was with anxiety. It doesn't have to be your whole life. Like you could just be like in a portion of your life, like at the beginning of COVID, where a lot of us were anxious, like this too shall pass. But once I got the ADHD final diagnosis, hey, this is what it is. It was awful because it was like, this is it for the rest of your life. But that doesn't have to be all of it. Like you can mitigate those symptoms and you can
that doesn't have work to be the end of the story.
Right. So,
and it can get better. The other thing I would say is one thing that anxiety, depression, OCD, probably ADHD to a good amount all have in common is you have thoughts in your head that you can't really control. You don't want them there and they are there. And I think that is one of the hardest things for people to talk about. And even just the previous recording that we just did with the postpartum, we struggle with that because we feel judgment on ourselves. We don't want other people to judge us too for the thoughts that are in our head. And let me just tell you right now, the thoughts in your head don't speak about how you are as a person or who you are as a person. That is the chemicals in your brain. And that's also the trauma in your past that is telling you things. That doesn't define who you are. What defines who you are is what you do, your actions with those thoughts in your head. So please, by all means, talk to somebody about it. When you have those thoughts, they are not there to help you more often than not, unfortunately. At some point, they probably were. They were there to protect you, or maybe they were there to help you in some way. Maybe they were there to prevent something that you couldn't see, and they were trying to help you get through something. Talk to people about them, especially if they're hurtful thoughts. Those aren't saying that you're a bad person. Those thoughts are there for a reason, and you need to talk about them. And maybe that reason is that there's something wrong going on and somebody needs to step in and help you. And that's okay, because we all need help sometimes. And our brains don't always work the way that they're supposed to. And the chemicals Correct. Can get messed up. And we have medication to help with that. And sometimes it's not easy. And I'm very sorry for anybody that's struggling through it. I'm very sorry for people who are seeking medical help and they have tried multiple medications and the medications aren't helping yet and they're still struggling. I've been there and I'm sorry. And I know it sucks and I know it hurts, but just keep trying. You will find the thing that's going to help you and it's worth it in the end. And it will get better.
Truly. One last thing about ADHD. The one thing that you need to know, I don't produce dopamine. Like I don't produce enough dopamine. Like everybody has dopamine in their brain. I just don't produce enough. And you would think, oh, that would make you sad. Well, yeah, it does make me sad, but doesn't make me depressed. But it also means that I don't have a lot of the same drive.
The motivation. That's like also the motivation chemical is what you told me in Montana.
Yeah. Yeah. That's the one. So a lot of motivation. And
So it is, there is like this physical thing that you can see where, and that's what the medication does. It does give me that dopamine that I don't get. And I just wanted to like put it out there that, and this is something that I do struggle with myself, is, you know, I am impulsive. And the reason that I am impulsive a lot of the times is because I don't have dopamine. So I will impulsively spend money so that I get a burst of, you know, man-made dopamine. And if you find yourself in situations where you're doing things impulsively like that, like spending, a lot of people with ADHD overspend, and to get that dopamine boost, you know, maybe talk to your doctor, because that can ruin you in a lot of ways. And when I didn't have my medication, that was one thing that I told Smith. I was like, hey, I will do this to get that dopamine. I need you to help me.
And empty your Amazon cart now.
Yeah, she's like, I see you putting stuff in your Amazon cart. Don't do that. So yeah, you know, that's another aspect of it that people just don't talk about. And again, if you see yourself with any of those symptoms like that, get tested. This is not going untreated. Like, you can live with it untreated, but nobody should have to live like that. By any means.
No, if you can. And also, just quick disclaimer, nothing that we're talking about, we are not medical health professionals. We cannot answer all of your questions. I am not licensed. None of us are licensed to help you. We are just telling you simply our own situations and our own things that we have gone through. We are all seeing medical health professionals, and much, much, much advice goes to going to them and seeing them. They know the right answers. They know the right places for you to go to. So please, 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 if you are going through any of these things, please seek medical help through a professional that can give you the right advice and can get you to the right person. And if it's not the right person the first time, that's okay. Go to the next person, because sometimes it doesn't work the first time, but second, third time might.
Yeah. My first therapist.
We're not doctors, as Montana has said multiple times. None of us are. But
he's a doctor.
We all know to go to the right place to get the help that we need. So very much encourage you to do so also.
Okay. Well, you know, take your pills, drink some water.
You thirsty bitches.
Until next time. We love you. We mean it.
Okay, bye.
The Reaper will come for us all.